Back in August, the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art announced its plans for a cultural district in Midtown. The idea actually goes back to the 1930s. A lot has changed since the 1930s. Heck, a lot has changed since the turn of the millennium, when First Fridays were still parties for artists and those in the know, and the Crossroads was an up-and-coming neighborhood. These days, we live in a city boasting multiple arts districts, a new world-class performing arts venue, and more. I'm Gina Kaufman. As the newest cultural district gets underway, Central Standard explores how these hives of creative energy relate to one another. Plus, the World Series has put us in a gambling mood. Coming up after this news. It was a pretty cool First Friday in the Crossroads this month, and the Royals were playing, so the crowds were a little sparser than usual. And although this arts event has been gaining popularity since the 1990s, it was Alex Graber's first Friday. He drove in from Olathe.
Walking around, checking out the shops. There's a lot of DJs and artists around here that are on the street performers and stuff. It's always fun to listen to.
To newcomers like Alex, First Fridays are a given, a staple of life in Kansas City. But 15, 20 years ago, the Crossroads, now throbbing with energy, pulsed beneath the surface. Artists and their cohorts made the neighborhood their playground. As for an arts district, the general public would have been hard-pressed to identify one. In the time that's passed, the arts have become a point of pride, and the desirability of arts districts has skyrocketed. The Crossroads reflects that. Meanwhile, artists are always finding new places to hum under the radar. Against this backdrop, the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art has announced plans for a cultural district connecting the museum with other hotspots in Midtown. As the museum convenes a meeting to discuss these plans with the public, Central Standard wants to know, what does it mean to be a cultural district? How do multiple arts districts interact with one another? And how many arts districts can a city our size sustain? Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. We've got a panel of guests to discuss this today. First, I'd like to welcome Catherine Footer. She's the Nelson's Curator of Architecture, Design, and Decorative Arts. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Well, what has been your role in developing these plans for the Cultural District?
Well, I'm going to back up just a little bit because last May of 2013, we added architecture to my department's title. And that was very strategic because Kansas City is bursting with amazing architecture, whether it's the great Art Deco buildings, the Nelson Atkins being one of them, but also City Hall, but to more recent projects like the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts and for the Block Building, it meant that, and we are also a center of architecture firms. And so we wanted to add that in addition to a new community initiative of urban planning. So the architecture sort of has a dual meaning in my departmental title.
Yeah, that's really interesting because usually when we think of curators and museum collections, we think of them curating objects within the collection. But you're talking about buildings as objects within the city and that being part of your purview.
Correct. And also we're working on our very first self-generated architecture exhibition that will open late February 2015. And we've used our local architecture talent, whether it's our principals from the architecture firms here to advise us about what the current trends and issues are. And so much of them are about connectivity, are about new innovations in technology, in communication, social media. And it's so much part of our culture here in Kansas City. So buildings, spaces, all need to be thought about sort of holistically.
That connectivity piece of it seems especially relevant when you're talking about a cultural district in Midtown, because a lot of the sites that the Nelson's talking about connecting through this district, they exist already. It's not the creation of these spaces. It's the connecting of them.
Correct. Actually, one of the projects is not to create new buildings, but actually to connect and to elevate the assets that we have in the area. There is not a sense of let's bring something new in, but let's really strengthen those physical connections because we have some of the programmatic connections. But how do we make it easier to go, say, from the museum to go to a performance at the Rep or to go to Linda Hall. They're so close. They're just a quarter of a mile away. But we all get in our cars or we all make separate dates to go do these different things, which are so close to each other.
Well, we're going to hear more about the specifics of the plan shortly, but I want to bring our other panelists into the conversation. We're joined by phone by Stephanie Leedy. Her father, artist Jim Leedy, is really closely identified with the Crossroads District. Stephanie now runs the Leedy Volkus Arts Center and manages a number of arts-oriented properties both within the Crossroads and outside the neighborhood. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Great. How are you this morning?
I'm good. Thank you.
So tell us from your perspective what it means to be an arts district.
Well, for the Crossroads District, it really is a collaboration of people who join with the same sort of identity, and that meaning galleries, shops. We're very close-knit community, and it's grown very slowly, which I think is one of the reasons why we are such a strong community. There are so many people that know each other and communicate well.
Well, we're going to hear more about that, but it's time now to also introduce Dawn Taylor. She's worked for both the Kemper and Nelson Museums in the past, and now she's executive director of the American Institute of Architects, located in the Crossroads. Hi, Dawn.
Good morning, Gina.
You spend your days working for an organization that focuses on the built environment. What can you tell us sort of broadly about the relationships between arts districts or cultural districts and their cities in 2014?
Wow, that's a great question, and it's important to know that, I mean, Kansas City has a lot to be proud of in the way of not only its arts and culture, but its entire creative economy, which architects and architecture are certainly part of that. And really, architecture embraces, as Catherine referenced somewhat, the design, the planning, the placemaking that's so important to what we're talking about in today's session.
Explain placemaking.
Well, you know, I'm by no means an expert in placemaking, but it has a lot to do with thinking about the human element. How do human beings, how do we all interact with these spaces we're talking about? How do you approach a museum in your car by foot on a bicycle? How do you bring a family into a museum? How do you cross a street like Cleaver Boulevard and go across to the beautiful green space through the sculpture park? You know, what are the things to anticipate of how the buildings and the green spaces and all of the public spaces will be used? And I think architects are very much uniquely qualified and trained really in their schooling to address these problems, to solve these issues, and to make the places that we all inhabit day by day, day to day, really easy to navigate, enriching to our lives, increasing the quality of our life. And I think this whole concept of a cultural district, whether it's in the existing one in the Crossroads or this proposed one in Midtown, are really about elevating our entire profile as a city and as a community and getting everyone to identify the strengths that we have here, play up those strengths, tell people about them when they travel out of town, welcome out of town guests. And, you know, it's really becomes a point of pride, the places that we call special in Kansas City.
Is this a trend we're seeing elsewhere, too? Is Kansas City the only place where people are taking a greater interest in capitalizing on the cachet of arts districts, in using arts districts to elevate that profile?
Well, I think it's one thing you could point to in our Crossroads District is certainly not only are there wonderful galleries like Leedy Volkus and all of the others, but a lot of my member firms at AIA Kansas City are located in the Crossroads. I mean, I can walk just a few blocks from my office and visit five of my firms within a few steps of each other, as well as, you know, digital design firms. A lot of the creative economy that's attracting so many, particularly young people, recent college graduates to our city and to settle particularly downtown and in the Midtown area and to have that kind of urban experience that we seem to be coming back to in our community. So I see all of the arts and culture district concepts as being really hand in glove with all of the other economic development opportunities going on in Kansas City, elevating us kind of to other markets that we're often compared to and sometimes feel like we're in competition with. I think I always say, be the benchmark. We should be the benchmark. We should be the one that other cities measure against, because I feel like this is Kansas City's moment, and we're doing a lot of things right. The biggest institutions like the Nelson Atkins Museum, the more professionally based organizations like AIA Kansas City, and so many other players are doing their part to make this – to really enhance Kansas City's cachet, if you will, and certainly livability and quality of life.
You can have a neighborhood that's full of cultural destinations, but that isn't necessarily labeled or recognized as a quote-unquote art district or cultural district. Do labels matter?
I think that's a great question. I think, as you mentioned earlier and what Stephanie was talking about too, you know, when the Crossroads developed in the 90s, I think everyone would agree it's been a very organic – that word gets thrown around a lot with the Crossroads District. It's been an organic growth. Artists moved in because the rents were affordable. It was easy to park your car. You know, there were – it was all really locally based, locally focused. And I think that as it grew, it wanted its own identity. I think even the Kansas City Star put a call out for what should we call this new burgeoning area, and Crossroads is what kind of came to the forefront. So I think as we look to what the Nelson Atkins is proposing and studying and calling the public together to help evaluate is how much do you design and how much do you allow to grow organically? And I think there's got to be a balance, like most of these things that we want to see develop. You know, there's got to be a balance in what you consciously and deliberately set out to do and set out to design, but to leave room for some of the serendipity that can happen that can make a place really have a special flavor.
That is such an interesting question, because that tension, or hopefully synergy, between organic development and planned development is huge for cities. To weigh in on this question about arts districts and how they relate to one another and to the city, call us at 816-235-2888. The number again is 816-235-2888. We'll be getting more on the story of the Crossroads from Stephanie Leedy in a little while, but first, Catherine Footer, tell us the basics of the Nelson's master plan for this anticipated cultural district in Midtown.
Well, actually, there's sort of two plans, because the museum will be developing its own master plan. But what we're talking about here is a cultural district. And actually, right now, we're just in the beginning of our process. So we've worked with the New York firm of Weissman Freddie, who are actually going to give a lecture at the museum this evening. I believe there's some seats still available. And we'll show about how they integrate architecture, landscape, and art to create a community and weave things together, weave these different aspects together. So in thinking about the cultural district, we're just at the beginning of thinking about different nodes, and these can shift. And our next step in the process is to involve the community and to find out what they think the strengths are, what are weaknesses, what are other ideas. This is just the beginning steps of it. And there'll even be a public charrette probably in early February, where really the public can vet, react to, maybe even come up with new concepts.
What is there anything at this stage that is a guiding principle, if you will, for what you plan to develop?
The guiding principle is really connectivity and highlighting those assets that already exist. And it's things which are, how do you cross Main Street at Cleaver? How do you cross Cleaver at Oak? Are those things. And thinking about, there's some really buried treasures, such as the Linda Hall Library and the National Museum of Toys and Miniatures, which will open next early late winter. And how do we elevate them to make them really part of all the assets that are in our community, as well as do economic driving and help the neighborhoods be woven together as well.
So, for example, though, what could that look like in really specific terms?
Well, it could be, one of the concepts is an elevated bridge that crosses Cleaver at Oak, whether that goes from the sculpture, the Donald J. Hall Sculpture Park to Tice Park and over, or whether it goes from Southmoreland Park. Again, those are all part of the conversations. But Tice Park, for instance, a park that is beautiful, but in some ways very underused. How do we create, I'd like to say, how does it become Loose Park? How does it become so interwoven with our fabric and yet maintain its identity? This is not about turning something into a homogenous. This is retaining the individual qualities and characteristics of neighborhoods, of institutions. This is not flattening everything. So there are specific crossing moments, and these are just, again, ideas. I've heard some people say, I don't want to see a crossing over Cleaver. Well, then maybe it's a crosswalk. The conversation needs to happen. And as Dawn mentioned, this is the moment. to seize that conversation.
The museum is holding, as you mentioned, a community event this evening, and representatives from the New York-based architecture firm tasked with developing this district and its structures are going to present their ideas in a talk called Public Natures, Envisioning a Cultural District. How do you think these kinds of exchanges between the firm and the community here in Kansas City will shape the project ultimately?
I think that, well, first of all, they're going to talk about their work tonight, not as a whole, not just the Kansas City project. But I think it's very important, first of all, when you have people who really participate, they have buy-in. Their ideas either are adopted, adapted, are considered, and they can see they are part of the process and as opposed to imposing something on a community. I think that's when you have a lot of disagreement and a lot of rejection of ideas. So this way, if we all move together, regardless of whether there's going to be pushback to any of the concepts that Weissman Freddy has put forward, but if we all work together to come up with better solutions, different solutions, that means that everybody in the end moves together through this, and we will succeed in it.
The firm's promotional materials express a fondness for superimposing what they call new programs on existing sites. What are some examples of ways they've done this elsewhere?
Well, their most famous and well-known project that many people have visited is the Olympic Sculpture Park, which actually was a project started by the Seattle Art Museum. And this took a piece of property with a lot of issues. It has train lines. It has highway. It had a huge grade down from elevated down to spectacular views of the ocean, but it was sort of abandoned. I don't want to say completely abandoned property, but not in a great neighborhood. And they created a destination. They improved the site with sculpture, a new events space. They have farmers markets, festivals there. It's helped to create new housing and improved residential neighborhoods, commercial neighborhoods. So it's become an economic driver. They're also working on the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., improving that, creating spaces where there'll be an amphitheater instead of buses idling for tourists. So they really look at sites and try to think about ways that they can become places where communities can gather.
You know, what's kind of interesting when I think about one of the goals that I've read is to connect the Nelson to something like the Plaza a little more mm-hmm. directly. But right now, there's just like a couple of blocks that you would walk down one street. There's a sidewalk. It's a walk I've done plenty of times, and I agree that in people's minds, there's a gap between these two locations. But in concrete physical reality, there is not a huge gap between these locations. There's not really a barrier to crossing. And I wonder, in that space between that very small space between the Nelson and the Plaza, there's maybe like not as that area, that block is not as thriving maybe as the Plaza. And I wonder if there's something like a bridge that takes people right over that area, if the area itself suffers.
We never had envisioned the bridge mm-hmm. climbing or soaring over the neighborhood. No, the neighborhood is very much integral to the cultural district. But what it is it connects more visually. So even one of the things that Weissman Freddy and the museum is very interested in is using sculpture and art as breadcrumbs, or going back to what Don was saying about placemaking. So if you're standing in the plaza and you say, where's the Nelson Atkins? You say, go down the street. See that sculpture down there? Make a left, as opposed to it's a quarter of a mile away, which for Kansas Cityans, I'm a New Yorker, so for a quarter of a mile, I know is only five blocks. But for some people, it's, oh, I have to get in the car.
The trail of breadcrumbs.
So the breadcrumbs are what, and that's what leading from breadcrumbs from the Nelson Atkins to UMKC, leading breadcrumbs from the Nelson Atkins to Troost. So it's all about connectivity. It's not about crossing or jumping over. No, it's not about eliminating or avoiding. It's all about actually strengthening and bringing together.
The breadcrumb analogy is a really interesting analogy. And the New York comparison interests me because there's this area, I mean, a lot of people know it, Museum Mile, where the heavy hitters are located museum-wise. But it's a district that you don't noticeably enter or mm-hmm. exit. Right now, it could be said that the Kemper and the Nelson and the Art Institute form a little museum quarter mile or half mile. I haven't measured, but why why do we as people in the city need to actively connect the dots? Could there be, without structures, a branding or a drawing attention to what is already a hive of cultural activity?
I think branding is very important in this. I think some of the solutions could be as simple as branding. But I do think that in more externally than internally in the that people know when they come that the Kemper is two blocks away, that they know the Kansas City Art Institute is across the street. I think Forest connected, but I think there's a greater population it's not connected.
What do you think that this cultural district will do for the aesthetic of Midtown or for the aesthetic identity of Kansas City?
I think it can, in a way, as sort of a placemaking branding, I think it could make it and so that people want to come and experience it. An example of that is the High Line in New York, which is a project by Diller Scofidio, a New York firm, another New York firm, which took abandoned infrastructure and has made it such a popular destination and economic attractor that there's cranes everywhere. And at 11:30 on a Saturday summer night, you cannot walk on it because it's so packed. So it's made a destination.
Central Standard is going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll turn to Stephanie Leedy to learn about the existing arts districts in town and to find out how they'll fit into the bigger picture. Don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Gina Kaufman. We've been hearing from Catherine Futter of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art and Don Taylor of the American Institute of Architects. Now let's talk with Stephanie Leedy. She runs the Leedy Vulcas Art Center, which was started by her father, artist Jim Leedy. And Stephanie, before they called the Crossroads, they called it Leedyville, right?
Called it Leedyville. I guess so.
So tell us, from your perspective, the story of how the Crossroads began.
Well, back in the early, mid-80s, my father, he had a gallery in Westport. He got priced out, basically. And so he decided the next time he would open a gallery, which was years later, he wanted to make sure that he owned his building so that he could no longer be priced out and his rent go up because he would own it. So he started looking in this area mostly because a lot due to the fact that Union Station, he knew that it would eventually, you know, that they wouldn't let it sit there forever.
And at this point it was closed.
Right. It had been closed for years. And Crown Center, I believe, has something to do with it. And it was just a good between, you know, given the fact that it's called the Crossroads, it's the crossway between Midtown and downtown. He bought a building, put three studios in it, started a gallery. And, you know, back then, things were inexpensive. It was easy enough to go down the street and buy another building. You know, times were different then. And then he encouraged other people to do the same.
And what would you say are some of the main milestones between this period you're describing where we've got, you know, some of the things that we think of as major anchors of that neighborhood now? Union Station is closed. There, a lot of the places that we think of now, like, I mean, Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, that's very new. All these things weren't there, and there are people, you know, easily buying buildings that are abandoned down the street. What are some of the major milestones between then and now where we see this thriving and very desirable community, desirable not just to the artists themselves, but to everyone?
Right. Milestones. There were just individual people who could purchase buildings and put their own identity into them. It was just such an easier time to do that. You know, the Performing Arts Center has been amazing. You know, the trick for us is going to be somewhere in the future being able to survive still as a arts district.
What would threaten that?
There's so many other, developers that have moved in. Our taxes have gone up. We've fought those. Art-related buildings have a tax freeze. We're just hoping that we can stay here and maintain our arts district, which, is going to be a challenge for us.
Do you see other neighborhoods being places that are doing things similar to what the Crossroads was doing, in the 80s and the 90s? Neighborhoods where artists who are looking for untapped opportunity are trying to create their own sort of satellite districts?
I think the West Bottoms is a good example. I love the antiques and the shops that are going down. I mean, when you go down there on a Saturday, it's amazing. You can't even find a place to park. And that's just, it makes sense for them to be in those, in that location. I'm sure the rents are reasonable for them. That's what used to happen here in the Crossroads. It was inexpensive, and that's where artists will always find their destination point.
I've heard it said that artists have an eye and an ability to work with materials that can often take a neighborhood with untapped structural potential and build it into something that then other people can see, and that this is sort of a predictable pattern of development and some might say gentrification. Do you think that is predictable, and what do you think is the relationship between these communities at different stages in development?
I guess, yeah, artists need to have freedom to, do what they want, whether it's, if they own a building, to embellish it in whatever way, to make it interesting, that people want to see what's inside of it, or, but it gets more difficult for areas, like you said, that have been gentrified. It's not as easy to go out in the street in the Crossroads now and do a wood carving when, it used to be that we could do something like that quite a few years ago.
Why can't you do it now?
Well, just because of the population of people that live down here, you're going to get, I know Stretch used to go out in the street on Wyandotte and make all sorts of noises in the middle of the night and nobody cared. But, it would be different now. Because people live down here, and it's something that we embrace and we love, but it's just the natural progression of things, and it's gonna change as it develops.
Dawn, what do you think about this idea of different arts districts with maybe they're different stages of the same thing, but maybe they're just places with different identities that coexist in one city?
Absolutely. Something that I keyed into what Stephanie just said really is important to my mind, which is that individual identity. She described how her dad had this, he was his own guy, he was his own person, buying buildings, didn't want his rent to go up, wanted to have his own studio space, wanted to show art, and encouraged others, John O'Brien, et cetera, to do similar things, buy property, set up their own thing. So it was very much, if I'm not putting words in Stephanie's mouth, it was very much driven by individuals, by what they needed, what even their vision was. Whereas I think, and that has worked for the Crossroads, and I think that is one of the single, one of the most important identifiers and characteristics of how that has grown to be what it is today. But I think in comparison, or maybe even contrast with what the Nelson Atkins is proposing and studying, is more of a communal view. These are institutionally driven ideas, but institutions that are public institutions. You have universities, you have museums, you have arts schools, theaters and the like. How do organizations approach creating a district where the assets are already there? I think what we're talking about are not, I don't think there's duplication of effort. I don't think there's repetition or redundancy with the Nelson Atkins, what they're proposing, and what the Crossroads already is, or even the West Bottoms. I think each of these neighborhoods or nodes or corridors have their own assets, their own environments, their own rhythms, their own flavor, all those kinds of, you know, descriptors. And I think your question at the top of the hour was, is there room for more than one, or how many can a market like ours sustain? I think more. I think we can do this and more. I think Kansas City has the appetite for it. I think we have a lot of the right ingredients in place and necessary requirements in place, if you will. We have smart people. We have dedicated people. We have creative people, all of which are trying to move this city forward and elevate us to the next level. So it's really an exciting time.
Yeah. Do you think that the city – that the market for it in Kansas City has grown or been educated and developed? Or do you think it was always there lying dormant and hungry?
I think that's a great question. I definitely think some of it has been an educational effort on the part of, again, the big institutions, the performing arts groups, visual arts groups, certainly the Arts Council. Arts KC has had a really active role, I believe. And then even, I would even say, groups like the Kansas City Area Development Council with their America's Creative Crossroads campaign, mm-hmm. which has really looked at or made people outside of Kansas City look at us and say, wow, they've got a lot of stuff going on. They've got very awesome chefs. They have digital designers. They have these UX people, user experience designers. That is all a really thriving, that creative economy, that creative class that Richard Florida wrote about, 2002? Gosh, mm-hmm. a long time ago, a dozen years ago. It is all playing out, and I think it's a really wonderful calling card for our community. You know, different communities have their story to tell or have their strengths, but, you know, this is what I feel like we're hitching our wagon to, and I think it's a very – it's a sustainable model. I think anything that – where people feel included in the decision-making, as Catherine mentioned, the museum wanting to invite public opinion – I've seen other groups do that. The Arts Council does that. I think Mid-America Regional Council does that. You know, our Midwestern sensibilities and you know, ability to embrace change might be a little slower than in other markets. But I think we do things thoughtfully here. And because of all these types of outlooks and perspectives, I think it bodes well for what the Nelson-Atkins is proposing and what other arts districts. West Bottoms, for sure, what they've got brewing down there is exciting as well.
Catherine Footer from the Nelson, when you hear these stories of other communities who in different ways in Kansas City have built something not identical to what you're talking about by any means, but the process of building a neighborhood with an identity that's attached to the arts, do you hear any lessons in these stories or concepts that you think you'll be tapping into as you move forward?
I think as we work with people who have gone through this process, whether it's in Kansas City or whether it's externally, I think we will learn some of the things. But going back to what Dawn said, Kansas City has its own identity. And one of the things that I've, in my time here, have learned is you can't impose some other community's ideas on Kansas City. It has its own rhythms. I agree with Dawn. I think they're speeding up a bit. And I think that also they are, again, we can't impose something that will not be bought into by our community. And also, going back also to something earlier, we are attracting people to Kansas City. It's not – people are coming. The Huffington Post naming Kansas City as the coolest city in the nation right now means that we are now in the millennials' forefront of their brains as a place to come and move with all this creative energy that is here.
Yeah, what do you think the arts has to do with that?
There is such – when people come here or they hear about Kansas City, they understand all the energy and the connectivity and the fact – I mean, there was just Evil Monkey the other day. And just all the people who are so excited about living in Kansas City right now.
Okay, Evil Monkey – I think we need to quickly explain what that is. And Stephanie, you might be the person to do that.
Well, that's an honorary barbecue. A large group of friends, that those friends keep growing every year. And it's an honorary barbecue that stems from John Puchak, who used to cook food for a lot of people. And he lived on Charlotte and the Charlotte Street Foundation. That sort of all... It's all sort of hand in hand. but, yeah, it's a wonderful barbecue. And it takes place, you know, John O'Brien has always initiated it. And it's just a wonderful wonderful way for people to get together and once a year and honor John Pucek and just everyone's friendship and love for one another.
So, but part of what this illustrates is that there are very tight-knit communities that attach themselves to these different arts districts. And Catherine Futter, what do you think about, how does the idea of community, you've talked a little bit about not superimposing or imposing an idea on a neighborhood. How do you tap into the community in your neighborhood as you move forward?
You listen. I mean, I think one of the things that we really have to do is listen, because each one of the communities has a different identity, and it's not, it's actually, we're now going to go into the listening part of the process, which I find very, very exciting.
Central Standard's going to take one more quick break. You might have time to weigh in this hour. We'll just have a moment when we come back, but give us a try, 816-235-2888. And before we wrap up this hour, we'll share your World Series wagers as part of our Tell KCUR series. Stay tuned. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is a conversation about the arts districts of Kansas City. To hear more about the Nelson Atkins plan for a Midtown Cultural District, head to the museum tonight at 6. The architects working on the project will be discussing their ideas pertaining to Kansas City and elsewhere. It's a ticketed event, so it might be wise to reserve a spot online before heading over. You can do that at nelsonatkins.org. That's nelson-atkins.org. And Catherine Futter of the Nelson, we were just talking a little while ago about connectivity and the neighborhoods. Brian tweeted us, today's topic is something I think about every day, and your guest is right on target. Would really like more focus east of Troost. So what are the ideas about how the Nelson's plan to create this cultural district would incorporate the area east of the museum?
Gina, it's a great question and something that we've talked about a lot, which is, at least what's on the table right now is the beginning of a concept, is that the museum might have an outpost on Troost or east of Troost. And it would be a place where we could have art classes, also engage with local and national or international artists. But we would also have part of the museum there, maybe fabrications workshop and non-art storage. So we would be part of that community. And I think that's a very exciting new step. And thinking about, but again, one of the ideas is to talk and listen to the community. We've met with some of the leaders there. And also we've talked about sculpture, which again, going back to the, as I talked about earlier, the breadcrumbs. So leading the breadcrumbs from maybe 71 or Paseo. Paseo already has monuments and art in it. So we could link that. And again, it's about that creative placemaking, but it's also about the communities.
Stephanie Leedy, when I think about the idea of the Nelson's expanding its neighborhood to include these areas further toward the east, I also think about the crossroads, which now we have the East Crossroads. And in fact, there are areas as far east as Troost and even further east that are kind of new territory for the arts moving east of the crossroads. Any words of wisdom or advice to the Nelson thinking about this project based on your experience of crossroads eastward expansion?
I think I tend to think that transportation is going to be, you know, when you go to another city, you stay in a hotel and you want to be able to get around the city easily. I think the streetcar, I think that's going to be important if it goes, east to the East Crossroads and 18th and Vine, that whole area. I just think it's important to be able to tap into that, to people coming in from out of town and really embrace that. There's hotels being built down here in the Crossroads. I know that there was possibly a plan for the Nelson, but I just think easy accessibility is going to be extremely important.
Dawn, what are your thoughts on this? And the role of arts institutions, arts communities in connecting maybe disconnected parts of our city?
Well, I mean, we've talked about how arts and culture can do that. Certainly, you know, improving the economic conditions in some of these neighborhoods. So, you know, some of the I think even some of the work through the Kansas City, Missouri School District's repurposing effort of their the schools that were shut down and are now being available for other uses. And some of those are being used as more affordable housing. Some are being used for senior housing. Some are being looked at for potential community centers. I think anytime you have a large, you know, beautiful historic era school building that was probably once the heart of its neighborhood, and if it could be brought back to be a viable connector again in certain neighborhoods, I think that would be great anchors. And again, those could be places where, you know, if a new multi-family living structure is in place, then that's going to probably bring in a gas station, a small grocery store, and some other amenities that people in that immediate neighborhood need. So then as kind of those, you know, base fundamental essentials are put in place, and then it builds some identity and builds in some room for maybe more arts and culture, maybe some green spaces, things like that.
Catherine, thinking about Kansas City in context of the region, when I see the visual mock-ups of some of these plans, it looks a little like I can see some synergy maybe with Crystal Bridges, where that's a museum that's interacting with a wide swath of land around it. What are your thoughts about connecting to other museums in the region?
Well, I think the museum is really interested in partnerships, both regionally, locally. But I think that right now our focus is really on the Kansas City community. I think our efforts are both we're doing international partnerships with exhibitions, but I really feel like our moment right now is to really concentrate on Kansas City. I'm not speaking for Julio. So.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up this. We'll be wrapping up this discussion now for today, but I'd like to thank everyone who participated. Dawn Taylor, thank you.
You're welcome.
And
nice
Stephanie Leedy, thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine Footer, thanks for sharing the Nelson's plans with us this morning to the extent that they've developed and letting us know how you plan to move forward.
Thank you, Gina. And we'll be keeping you all up to date as to what is going to happen next.
We will be continuing our conversation about this plan as it develops here on KCUR. And I'm looking forward to seeing how it all plays out.
Why don't you talk?
It's time for our weekly Tell KCUR segment here on Central Standard. And for that, we are joined by Allison Rollett. She's the social media producer here at KCUR. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Gina.
What did we ask people this week?
Well, Gina, as you know, the Kansas City Royals are in the World Series this week playing against the San Francisco Giants.
Oh, yeah. I think I've heard that.
Yeah. And there's a lot of friendly wagering, a little friendly betting going on. And so we wanted to ask, if it were up to you, what should the World Series bet be between Kansas City and San Francisco?
So these aren't actual nominations, but they're like in a dream world, if we could wager anything,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Definitely. Like, you know, last week during the American League Championship Series, which we all know the Royals won, there was that famous bet between the Kansas City and Baltimore police departments. And Baltimore said if they lost, they'd be sending us a bunch of crab cakes. If we lost, we'd be sending them a bunch of Kansas City barbecue. And we all know what happened. And so Kansas City police, if they don't have their crab cakes yet, they should be getting them soon. And while that was a really fun bet that got a lot of attention.
Yeah, I want to try some of those crab cakes.
I know. It's been really, really copied. So we're seeing a lot of barbecue bets around town, and we wanted Kansas City to get a little bit more creative, and we wanted to see what they had. Since we've been airing our question all week, we did find out that the mayors of Kansas City and San Francisco have come up with an official wager, and so just to kind of get the juices flowing, I'll tell you all about that.
Please.
If the Royals win, San Francisco Mayor Edwin Lee will actually come to Kansas City and read to local students, part of a citywide literacy initiative. And he'll also bring some famous San Francisco sourdough bread and ice cream. And then, of course, if Mayor Sly James of Kansas City, Missouri, his part of the deal, if the Giants win, is he'll bring some barbecue to San Francisco. But he's also going to sing and dance in this ensemble band aimed at promoting diversity. And he'll also serve meals to the homeless.
So these are very civically minded.
Yeah, civically minded. And they got creative. They got creative.
What did people say?
Landmarks and places were a common response from from people. Angelique on Facebook wants the keys to Alcatraz if the Giants lose.
It's pretty snazzy in there for a prison.
Definitely. And several people want the Golden Gate Bridge if San Francisco loses.
Where would we put it?
Moy on Facebook has an idea. Moy says, let's bet the Bond Bridge against the Golden Gate one. Then we won't be sorry to lose. So,
aww.
I know, not really a great statement about the Bond Bridge. But, I mean, hey, it's the Golden Gate Bridge.
I know, they really hard to beat that one.
Yeah. And then also Greg Curtin, he had an idea about companies and businesses. He wants to relocate Twitter to Kansas City. For those of you who don't know, Twitter's headquarters is in San Francisco. And we also had a couple of music ideas. Like Stephanie on Facebook, she said, when we win, they should send Journey.
You know, I like that she said, when we win.
I know, I know. And then again, if we were to lose, send them some Kansas City barbecue. The barbecue keeps coming back up. I like this one from Mitchell on Twitter. He says, San Francisco City Hall should play the song Kansas City, the Wilbert Harrison version, over building audio system if San Francisco wins. And Kansas City will play I Left My Heart in San Francisco if the Giants win. So
I kind of like that. An artistic wager.
Yes. And then we had kind of an environmental social wager. Jonathan on Twitter said if San Francisco wins, Kansas City should ban the use of plastic grocery bags. And if Kansas City wins, every public fountain in San Francisco should be dyed blue for the year. I thought that was kind of funny. I'm not sure if the blue dye is environmentally friendly or not. But, you know, hey, you know, it's a fake bet, so I guess we'll go with it. But by far, Gina, like those were some of the kind of outliers. By far, we got a slew of food and drink wagers. People not only went from barbecue, they went to chocolate, they went to Rice-A-Roni, they went to like all sorts of things. Just to run through a few, Ghirardelli is, you know, their headquarters is in San Francisco. So people wanted some of that chocolate.
Do we give them back for that? Do we give them some of our own chocolate or something else?
I figured people would say Russell Stover because, I mean, that's kind of comparable to Ghirardelli. But Denise Compton on Facebook said, if they win, we can send them Christopher Elbow chocolates. And then people quickly pointed out that actually San Francisco is one of the other few places in the world that has a Christopher Elbow. So I don't know if that would work out so well.
Yeah.
But it was creative. You could tell some people had been, you know, to San Francisco because we had a couple of like really local requests. Like Mo on Facebook said he wanted a Chiopino, which is a fish stew you can only get in San Francisco. And it's really famous from the Fisherman's Wharf. And of course, we would kind of trade that for burnt ends. And then someone said shrimp cocktails, fresh from Pier 39, which if you've been to San Francisco, that's a popular pier and tourist attraction, kind of like the Navy Pier in Chicago. This was kind of creative and classy. Robin on Facebook said, a couple of crates of good California wine for the Royals, a nice selection of KC prime beef if the Giants win. So,
locavore.
There you go. There you go. And then Leslie said, San Francisco, forget the sourdough bread, which we also got a lot of requests for. She said, send Chinese food instead. And as we all know, San Francisco has a really famous Chinatown. So I was actually surprised Chinese food didn't come up anymore.
Yeah, for delivery. Long distance delivery.
Yes, yes.
Were there any like actual bets that people had on the table that they shared with us?
Yeah, actually, we had a few kind of community or civic organizations that kind of almost kind of use this tell case you are experience, this query, if you will, to kind of initiate some bets with some other folks, some like kind of smaller businesses in Kansas City. And then we also had the Nelson Ekins reach out to us. They said that their CEO, Julian Zugazagoria, he has kind of challenged Colin Bailey, who's the director of the DeYoung and Legion of Honor Museums in San Francisco. And it's a really interesting little wager. It's kind of halfway through because they haven't heard back from San Francisco yet. They're supposed to hear back tomorrow.
Pressure's on.
The pressure is on. But yesterday, they put up an Andy Warhol work, kind of a silk screen on canvas called Baseball. And it's a black and white, it's really cool piece with a lot of repetition of these baseball images, and they hung it in the museum yesterday
at the Nelson,
and they said if the Royals lose, they're going to lend that to the museums in San Francisco. So that would be a really interesting wager because it would be art from the Kansas City collection and the Nelson Ekins actually going across state lines all the way to San Francisco if they lose. So that's actually a lot more than just some barbecue. But, you know, I asked them, what do they want? You know, what do they want San Francisco
to
give?
Yeah, what does the DeYoung have?
And we just haven't heard back. So I guess we'll probably hear later this week what San Francisco is willing to give up.
Allison Rollitt, social media producer here at KCUR, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Gina, and good luck to the Royals this week.
That's all the time we have for today's show. To listen back to anything you've heard here on Central Standard, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there, and don't forget you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at @KCURCST. Tomorrow, we're headed to the coffee shops and coffee houses. With so many new coffee communities bubbling up around town and new trends galore, our food critics will recommend their favorite spots for a cup of joe, be it the nostalgic diner variety or the specialty drink at the upscale cafe. Tune in for that tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross and Matthew Long Middleton. The sound from First Fridays you heard at the beginning of the show was collected by CJ Janovi. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today's show. Stick around for Up to Date next.